You can't start the car. Johnny has the keys.
Hello, hello, hello out there in podcast and YouTube land. We are Johnny Has the Keys. Johnny Has the Keys is a program that talks about key elements of horror and science fiction movies and those little things that lift them above the average genre fare. If you are joining us for the first time, we are very happy that you're here. Welcome. We're not sure how you heard, but if you would, let someone else know or post a rating or ring a bell or follow us. You can find us on Facebook as well as YouTube. If you are rejoining us because you've been listening to us for a while, welcome back. We are happy to be here and happy to have you. I am with my good friend and co-host David Horton, and we are in his world of science fiction this week. How are you doing, David?
I'm doing well. I'm excited we're in science fiction. And I'm actually excited about this one. This is a kind of a different, weird sort of anomaly of a movie, so it'll be interesting to see your reaction to it, since I have no clue what you're going to think. Normally we say what we've done genre-wise. Genre-wise, I did something kind of interesting. I had gotten a book for Christmas, which was a tabletop book. And it was the making, essentially the entire making, the behind the scenes, everything, the design for Tim Burton's Dark Shadows, the one that
with Johnny Depp.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And not the greatest movie ever made, not the greatest adapt of that, definitely. But the amount of work that went into it was really, really interesting. And so I've been reading that book this past week, just of the design elements and Burton trying to stay true to Dark Shadows, but also I'm Burton, so I got to do my thing. And it was very interesting to see that, how that creative process kind of built together.
I find that fascinating. You may know this about me, but I am a Dark Shadows aficionado. Back when it was airing on Sci-Fi in the early 2000s, I watched all 1,200 episodes.
Oh, my gosh.
And let me tell you, you have to get through some really bad stuff to see the occasional nugget of something good on show.
Oh, yeah. I still remember seeing, watching it in the, I still remember that was my prelude to Star Trek. You know, I would every afternoon after school rush home, get off the bus. It was Dark Shadows first, and then it was Star Trek, back to back. And, the cameras were so bad that they were picked,
everything.
The fireplace was overlit and blooming
out. The walls
out.
Moved when they bumped into them. Flies would land on their face, and they were filming live, and they couldn't swat at the fly. I can't tell you how many times I saw Barnabas with a fly on his forehead, and he's a vampire. Crazy stuff happened. And that was the actually, part of the nuggets that I loved was when things went wrong, because they're hilarious to see.
Oh, yeah. Well, they did it like a straight three-camera setup, right? And they just did it just like a normal soap opera. And we're going, and here we go, and we're done for the day. And we'll record. We'll see you tomorrow. Here's your new pages.
And they did an episode every day, whatever, 300 days a year, however many days there are in a year, weekdays. And they did it for 6 years. So, I mean, they ended up having, 1,000 episodes. It was crazy.
And you watched them all?
Yes. I watched every single one of them to the end. And I watched, we would record a bunch of them and just sit down and watch five at once. They went from black and white to color. They went from being kind of a gothic ghost story to introducing Barnabas the vampire, and all of a sudden the popularity grew, so they brought in a werewolf and a witch, and then I started realizing, this is where Anne Rice got a lot of her ideas. I'm starting to see, and they're also universal ideas, they borrowed them from the Universal Monsters.
Angelique and the rest of them.
Angelique was probably my favorite character. And, of course, other celebrities were on the show. Kate Jackson ended up on there one time before Charlie's Angels. I mean, wow. it's just a treasure chest of daytime horror schlock that I just adore. And so I've seen that Tim Burton movie, but I've only seen it once. I should go revisit it. I really should.
I want to revisit it now after reading, you know, through this book. It was very interesting because it reminded me of a key I should have done but didn't for when we did Salem's Lot, which is I remember the 70s version of Dark Shadows when they had the movie.
There's two movies. Yeah. Yeah. And Dan Curtis did them both.
Dan Curtis did it. And one was, I think, I remember being very scary. I mean, especially in the 70s, it was scary to me. But when, what's his name? The weird handyman, Renfield-ish.
Willie.
Yeah. Revives.
I think his last name's Loomis. It's Willie something. It may be Willie Loomis.
Well, there you go. That's some kind of keys into everything.
Right.
But when he revives Barnabas, they do the whole, you know, hand coming out and grabbing him by the throat thing, which is
out of very the chain coffin, mm-hmm.
Salem's Lot ish, mm-hmm. you know, sort mm-hmm. of thing. It's interesting. I remembered that. Anyway, well, I thought you would enjoy that as a what my genre week was. You know?
That first movie you're talking about was called House of Dark Shadows, and they basically just took the key elements from the soap and redid them in color. As far as Barnabas arriving at Collinwood. The right. second one was called House of Dark Shadows. Excuse me. That was House of Dark Shadows. The second one was called Night of Dark Shadows, and it pales by comparison, and it's really hard to get through.
Mm, okay.
But they're both Dan All Curtis. Right. So it's just like soap opera television elevated just a little bit. Yeah. Elevated to like Burnt Offerings Trilogy of Terror status.
There you go.
Which he also did. But yeah,
well, what about you? Story. What were you doing?
This is not a found footage movie, which I told you I'd been finding myself in that category for a little while.
Yeah.
But I've got a list of movies I made that got really high ratings on Rotten Tomatoes. And I thought, well, these are the horror movies that I can stream. Let's see what they're like. So I'm kind of checking them off my list. And the one I watched was Cam. And it's got an actress in it. I believe you know who she is. I didn't write any of this stuff down, but you said that she was really good on Midwives. I mean, what's the name of that show?
Handmaid's Tale. Yeah, Madeline Brewer. She's really, really good. She's awesome.
Well, she's great in this. She is really, really good.
Well, she's probably one of the better elements of Handmaid's Tale. The way they've done that character that she plays is really good. So, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, this movie is very unique, and I would recommend it. I don't know that I would go as far as to recommend it for the podcast. I'd kind of like to get your interpretation on it, and maybe we'll consider it.
Okay.
But it's basically about a cam girl. These are women that make money being provocative on camera for coins.
I mean, yeah, I've heard that.
And she, I don't know if I should give it. Well, I'll give it away. This is a small plot point. The main thing is that she is trying to get in the top 50 and be this one, you know, highly paid cam girl. And one day she realizes that her identity has literally been stolen, and she is on camera live. And has been locked out of her account. And all of a sudden, she's reaching those high numbers, and she's not reaping the benefits, and weird things are starting to happen. So it's kind of like a case of literal identity theft. Like, she's literally been recreated and put in her own scenario.
So is it like a Michael Crichton technology created her? Or is it a somebody impersonating her villainy thing?
Well, that's kind of where it falls apart. In the third act, some of the things I'm not satisfied with the way they explain them.
Okay.
So I'll just leave it at that.
All right.
But yeah, I guess you would say it does have kind of a sci-fi twist, though, too, as far as being a hybrid, a sci-fi horror hybrid.
Well, you know how Crichton was kind of, I can't remember it wasn't Scanners, but it was something like that. The Crichton film where they were recreating people, they were doing full body scans and then making duplicates of them.
I didn't read that one. Is that the one with nanotechnology maybe?
They did a film of it. I just cannot remember the title right now, but it was something like a one word title, like Scanners or Streamers or something. I can't remember. But anyway, but it was that kind of thing where almost Stepford Wivesy, you know, meet your, you know, they duplicate you and then they make you a better person.
Are you talking old Crichton or new Crichton?
No, old Crichton. It was probably 80s. 80s, yeah.
Oh, I thought you were, like, the last thing I saw was Timeline, which, you know, that started going, he started going downhill for me then. But, I know what you, now I'm baffled. I kind of want to figure out what it is because.
I want to look it up real quick and see if I can find it because I know that it
was. We know he did Westworld. We know he did. Didn't he have something to do with Demon Seed, that Dean Koontz novel, maybe?
Well, his first one was Andromeda Strain, one of my favorite.
Right.
Westworld. He did the one with Gene Simmons.
Runaway. Ooh.
Runaway. Coma.
Coma was a big one. That was about body
harvesting. The name
harvesting.
Of it was Looker.
You know, you mentioned this movie to me in a podcast, and I did not remember it. The one thing about this is it's got a lot of modern things in it, like, you know, her trying to break back into her account, creating fake identities and going in and tipping herself, that kind of stuff. You know, she is smart at trying to figure out how to get behind what exactly is going on. But there's also some personal scares as well, like she has a stalker as well. So yeah, I'll be curious to see your take on it. I think you would like it. Well, you're going to like it for the call girl stuff anyway, but it's still got some interesting plot things about it. So that was my week in horror.
We've got a film today that's kind of a weird amalgam too, that to me has a really cool third act that is hampered by bad special effects and stuff.
Yeah, a little bit.
But it's kind of a hybrid too. Is it science fiction? Is it horror? Because people tried to push it as either one, as both. And I remember seeing this. My first experience was Shock Theater. It's the first time I saw it. Again, that Saturday afternoon sort of thing. And saw it several times. We're talking about a little film from 1967, which was a Hammer movie. And basically kind of like revitalized Hammer for a bit because it was a very popular movie based on what the British called a serial, which we would call a mini series that was told the same story, but it's Quatermass and the Pit. And it was actually, if you're not familiar with that title, it could be because in America and certain other markets, it was not distributed that way. They changed the title to be 5 Million Years to Earth, which is the way I originally saw it. And I really thought that was the original title and that this one was just a fake one that the British had thrown on.
Well, and I always thought it was Quatermass with an R, like a quarter coin.
Yep.
And not only is it not Quatermass, it's Quatermass, or at least that's how they pronounce it. Yeah.
It's Quatermass. And I thought the same thing. For years and decades, I thought it was Quatermass. Mm-hmm. You know, and I have never seen any of the original British serials that this was based on. They were all written by a screenwriter named Nigel Neal, with a K, who was a very prolific. He was like sort of a Rod Serling to British television, a precursor to Doctor Who, a precursor to a lot of the BBC programming, but they had a lot of serials based on his works and several movies. This one, the screenplay was written by him, and it was directed by Roy Ward Baker, who was a very big British director at the time.
Yeah, he did like some great movies. Mm-hmm. Great Hammer movies in particular, one that we talk about a lot, Asylum.
Oh, yeah.
That movie that's a bunch of vignettes woven together, the one with the guy going through the maze with all the razor blades on the wall.
Well, and he had come from a very popular movie at the time called A Night to Remember, which was mm-hmm. the, you know, one at that time, like a love letter to the Titanic.
That was my mother's favorite Titanic movie.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And he had done several seasons of The Avengers for television. Mm-hmm. So he was a very well-known director. And it had a fairly strong cast with it, too. Do you remember the first time you saw this movie before we get into details?
Well, funny you should ask. Because I went into this thinking I've never seen it. However, when I was a child, I have the distinct memory of an event in a movie that I've never been able to place. I have told you about this kind of thing before with a movie called The Bubble, where I said, I know this movie exists, and it took me forever of Googling and stuff, and then finally realized it was actually called The Bubble, and it was about this town encapsulated by aliens in a glass dome,
okay,
or a force field or whatever. Well, this one, when I was a kid, I always knew I saw this movie about a guy on a crane fighting a giant flaming monster. And I used to get it confused with the Hellfighters movie that John Wayne did. And I thought, was there a monster flaming in that John Wayne movie where they are firefighters? And I just finally just thought, you know what? It must have just been a dream, and I just gave it up. You know, I never saw it. And then, lo and behold, at the end of this movie, a guy is on a crane fighting a giant glowing monster that basically mm-hmm. looks like a silhouette with eye holes, which is what I remember in The Flames.
Oh, yeah.
So yeah. I think you have helped me rediscover a movie I had buried from my childhood.
Interesting. Isn't that crazy how we get those certain images and we know we've seen it, but we don't know from what? And then suddenly we stumble upon it and you go, that's it. That's what I remember. I'm not crazy.
I remember. So nostalgically, it hit me in in the G spot. I was like, wow, this is awesome. I finally know what this is.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's awesome. I have several of those. I mean, I remember distinctly the ship design, which I thought was so cool, and the mm-hmm. fact that it looked like it was out of some material that I could not fathom what it was. Mm-hmm. The insects when they first come out and they're in the hexagon, like behind you in the image, when they're actually, you know, the first time you see them, that whole ending with the crane, those images were just seared in me when I was a kid, and I really liked them, and I thought it was a really and plus the fact the audio design, I really remember that weird energy pulse wind weirdness that happens every time the telekinesis starts. It's a very weird sound, which maybe I'll find online and put in the podcast when I edit this. But it's a very weird, strange sound that always kind of haunted me. I always thought it was really weird and cool. For those of you who haven't watched this, go watch it before you listen to us, because now we spoiled
it.
There's a crane in it, by the way.
With a
giant monster at the end. But it's very unique to describe this movie in a synopsis, because it is a lot of really heady intellectual stuff squeezed into a 90-minute kind of television-y style film, in my opinion. But basically, you have an excavating team is digging out the London Tube, making a new station in an area called Hobbs Lane, and they end up finding skeletal remains. So they call in an archaeologist, Dr. Rooney, Ronnie, that's it.
Ronnie, yeah.
Dr. Roney, who brings his lovely assistant Barbara, and they go to find these relics. When they further excavate and find something metallic, the military is called in because now they think it might be an unexploded bomb,
a bomb
from World War II. So they've got to do more excavation. Along this, when they bring in the military, they bring in a character named Colonel Breen, who basically turns out to be the villain of the piece, sort of. But villain is with a very well-known popular scientist named Quatermass. And Quatermass comes from a long lineage in Britain. So if you were a British child watching this, you would immediately know, oh, that's Quatermass. He was
just like Sherlock Holmes.
Correct. Yeah. Correct. He's basically the Indiana Jones meets Sherlock Holmes of Britain in the early 50s and 60s. He was involved in the Rocket X project, which was basically his entire intent was to create a space program for England that would end up taking them to colonize the moon and then colonize Mars. So basically, he and Breen show up at this excavation. He immediately thinks this might be something other than an unexploded bomb. Turns out that he's right. And the last act of this is basically coming to grips with the fact that all life on Earth is really a hybrid, or human life on Earth is really a hybrid of humans and Martians. And we have genetic memory that dates back, you know, centuries and millions of years. And we can still be controlled by certain elements from the Martian technology, if that makes sense. And it's about how we defeat that at the end. Does that pretty much sum up that as far as the synopsis, you think?
Yeah, it does. Well, I'll get to it in case. But yeah, it's very similar to another story that I know.
Oh, okay. Well, I mean, yes, because it does have a lot of keys, I think, in it. Some history and production about it. Quatermass was actually, by the time this movie was made in 67, it was a 50-year-old series. The original books and everything had come out 50 years earlier.
I didn't even realize that. I thought it was just a TV series. So it had, there were books before?
Yeah, yeah. This was a huge thing. And Nigel Neal, who wrote and originated, was very influenced by H.G. Wells. H.G. Wells was his hero, and obviously you can see that in everything that he's done since then. It was several serials or mini-series, so to speak, on the BBC. It was two other movies and then even another remake after that. I've got in my notes that this was actually the resurgence of Hammer or the start of Hammer. But Hammer was in the 50s, right?
Yeah, it was in the 50s. It's not. It may be a resurge.
So this was the resurgence because with the success of this and with Roy Ward on board, that gave them all their stuff.
Well, they brought some money in, and Roy Ward did several good Hammer movies. He did, we mentioned Asylum. He also did The Vampire Lovers, which was, I don't know, I don't remember how good it is, but it had like, you know, a lesbian vibe that was very sexual that people gravitated to. He did Scars of Dracula, which was another Christopher Lee vehicle, as well as Dr. Jekyll and Sister Hyde. He did The Vault of Horror, which is another, it was kind of a sequel to Tales of the Crypt, the one we talked about with Joan Collins. And then he also did And Now the Screaming Starts, which is another, I'm pretty sure, Cushing Lee vehicle. So, whether or not it definitely wasn't the beginning of Hammer, but it could have definitely been a resurgence, like you said.
And it was definitely a Hammer film. You could tell from the lighting, from the color choices.
It's gorgeous.
Their palettes are so incredible in all the Hammer films, and this was a great example of that. Making the ship like that pseudo really deep green, I thought was a great choice, especially since he jumps to the almost insanely conclusion of, oh, it's from Mars. Sure it is. Of course. Obviously.
Well, they had to colonize us because their planet was freezing.
Their planet was dead. Yes. Or whatever. Now, I will say for all of you guys out there listening, this is a hard movie to find.
Yes.
Well, you basically end up having to order and buy a DVD of this because you cannot find it streaming. You cannot find it in pieces, parts, anywhere.
No, I even checked like BritBox and stuff and could not find it on a British streaming service.
Which is interesting. And I wonder if there's some kind of, you know, a secret cabal that just wants Quatermass to not be around because it essentially could have been as popular as a Sherlock Holmes or as a Doctor Who.
If you want to know the truth, I think it's random. Whenever I searched it, TCM would come up, which makes me think that it maybe is sometimes on Turner Classic Movies and they own it or something.
Well, that would make sense.
It would make sense. But, a lot of the movies that we choose, it really burns me up because we'll have to rent them. And then the very next month they're on Shudder or Amazon. And I'm like, what the hell? Why did we have to pay for this? We could have just streamed it if we'd have been recording a month later. In this case, we had to reschedule our recording schedule because we had to wait on DVDs to come in the mail for this one.
Yeah.
So,
yeah, essentially. But I'm glad. I'm glad I own the Blu-ray.
I like it. Yeah, absolutely.
Because I really enjoyed it, and it did bring back a lot of childhood memories. It also, I really think it was, they were trying so hard to tell a really, really science fiction heady plot with the themes of, you know, genetic memory and cultural memory, racism, colonization, all of this stuff was really interesting. I think they kind of missed the mark in a few places, I think. But I love the casting. I like the production design, the photography. I mean, it was a good ride for me.
Yeah, yeah, I thoroughly enjoyed it. And you mentioned Neil. Nigel Neal. He's got a K in front of his last name, doesn't he?
He does.
Yeah.
With an E at the end.
Right. Nigel Neal wrote
so
this.
British, you know. Oh, my goodness.
And very British. Apparently, most of what he did was in the UK. However, I don't know if you knew this. He stepped outside of the UK once and wrote a movie we're all familiar with that was much maligned, or what's the word I'm looking for? Much hated when it first came out and is now lauded as being one of the better entries of the series, and that is Halloween 3, Season of the Witch. Did you know
he wrote that?
Yes, he wrote it, but he sued to have his name removed from it because he didn't like the violence and gore.
Well, I think it was, again, that was a great idea that was probably hampered by some, you know, terrible production values and scripting.
Well, think about the overall elements of it. It was technology meets paganism.
Yep.
And there, I mean, just those two concepts alone kind of contrast with each other. So to marry them in a script even sounds like something he would do because of all the stuff he marries in this script.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I could see that.
So anyway, I just found that interesting that he also worked on a Carpenter-produced project.
Speaking of cultural memory or genetic memory, I see a lot when we do British films, they own a lot to their ancestral pagan roots. There's a lot of
Celtic Druid.
And pagan, all that stuff is kind of intertwined in a lot of British literature, British filmmaking, character development, all that stuff.
Yeah, when we did Curse of the Demon, that immediately comes to mind.
Yeah.
Or The Devil Rides Out.
Wicker Man, all of that is...
Wicker Man, all three of those.
You know, so those are all like thematics that I think kind of thread through this.
Mm-hmm.
What did you think of the cast of this? I thought the cast was really strong and really great. I had never seen, nor I think since, seen the guy that plays Quatermass, Andrew Keir.
I haven't either. I've got a few notes on him, but I don't know much about him at all. I do know that two Quatermass films preceded this one that Nigel Neal did not like the actor who played Quatermass.
Right.
So this was considered a resurgence of not only Hammer, but Quatermass itself, because Nigel Neal endorsed it, whereas he didn't endorse the first two films.
Good, good.
Yeah.
I mean, guys, I had read that Anthony Quayle was going to do the part.
I got that too. I don't know who that is, though. Do you?
He was one of those big character actors who had this particular look, and he kept it the whole time. He was in some kind of I'm trying to remember.
Okay. Well, while you're remembering, I can tell you that the guy that was playing him beforehand was an American named Brian Donnelly, and Neil did not like him at all. And it says that he was much happier with Andrew Keir's performance as the title character as opposed to Brian Donnelly's in The Quatermass Experiment and Quatermass 2, which were those two films I was talking about.
But that was different, I assume, than the whatever actor played it in the series or the serials.
More than likely, yeah. And in all honesty, I looked them all up on IMDb, and the first two get high ratings as well as this one. So maybe it's not all that bad. I don't know.
Yeah. Well, Anthony Quayle was in Lawrence of Arabia, Guns of Navarone.
Okay.
He was a big British actor, and that's the impression I got from the entire male cast of this, not Barbara so much, because Barbara, from what I read, went on to do a bunch of Hammer. But
they don't utilize her much. She was a victim of the time.
Yeah, but the male cast in this was very big in British theater and British television and very well-known actors. Even though, like I said, Andrew Keir, I never saw again anywhere else, but I thought he was great.
Oh, he is great. He's got one of those great voices that sounds Shakespearean.
Yes. Yeah.
Let's see. What else do I have? I have that Roy Ward Baker was he originally wanted a guy named Kenneth Moore. Do you know who that is?
Nope.
All of these guys are British actors, so I don't really recognize them. Right. But various books on Hammer claim that he was vetoed by Hammer. Hammer said, no, we want Andrew Keir. You don't get to make that decision, Mr. Director.
Well, there you go. What do you think? This is yours?
Yeah. And then early UK posters feature an illustration of John Neville as Quatermass, suggesting that he was at one time a candidate for the role. Now, do you know who John Neville is? Because I do know who he is.
Who is he?
He is the well-manicured man from The X-Files.
Oh.
Yeah, okay. Exactly. I was like, okay, I could see that because he's great.
I could see that.
So I found that fascinating.
I think Keir is just so, I mean, the ones I recognized definitely from this was I immediately, and I'd forgotten this, you know, because again, childhood memories brought back and everything else. But as soon as I saw Colonel Breen and it was Julian Glover, I went, oh my God, that's the bad guy in Lost Crusade. That's the guy from Star Wars. I mean, he's been in everything.
I want to say he was like a minor character in a Monty Python movie too, but I could be wrong because he looked so familiar to me.
It might have been, yeah.
You know how sometimes they would have somebody that wasn't of the original troupe in there.
Yeah.
But I could be wrong.
I mean, I remember he was one of the old priests in Game of Thrones. He was in...
I don't have pictures of all these guys.
But he was really great. And he plays a village idiot, essentially. He refuses to believe anything.
Maybe it's because he reminds me a little bit of Graham Chapman in that military garb where he's like, you know, this is too silly. Stop it.
They come at you with a banana.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, right. So maybe that's what I'm thinking. But yeah, he's great. I don't know if you watched his interview on the DVD, but he has an interview on it.
No, not yet.
Yeah, yeah, it's good.
He's done some incredibly good movies, and he's always very good at this part. He's great at this part. You love to hate him because he's like a foil for Quatermass, but... You know, he just keeps making bad decisions the entire time.
His name is Julian Glover. You said Barbara Shelley. I really don't have anything else for anybody. I did want to mention the guy, Duncan Lamont, who played Sladen. He's in this picture. Isn't that him? I think that's him.
Yeah, he's the one that saw it first.
Yeah, he's great, man. He's like right out of a Stephen King novel. he's really good.
Yeah, my keys for him were Stephen King, ironically, you said that. But the other one, you know, Barbara Shelley, let's talk about her for a second, because she was from the Avengers too. She had done like 3 years of the Avengers. Okay.
And for those of you out there, we are not talking about Marvel. We are talking about the British Avengers television show with, I can't remember those characters' names.
Emma Peel.
Right.
And,
is the actress.
And played by, what's her name from,
Is that the character name?
Yeah, Emma Peel.
Oh, I'm sorry. I thought it was the actress' name.
Oh, no. She was great. And John Steed was, Patrick McNee.
And they did make that into a movie with like Ralph Fiennes, maybe.
Yes. Yeah. They remade it into a movie. And if you are of a younger generation, I guess, and you watch the, what's the series? They're about to come out with a third one of the Gentleman's Club, the British Gentleman's Secret Service guys. I didn't do the research on that. What's it? But basically those three films, the third one's getting ready to come out, but those three films are really less a takeoff of James Bond and more a takeoff of the Avengers, the original British series that had the gentleman secret agent, who always wore a bowler hat. And
is
had
it
an
the
umbrella.
Kingsman?
Yes, Kingsman.
Okay.
Thank you so much.
I figured it wasn't Pussy Island because I just saw that.
That's a James Bond movie. No,
no. Apparently, it's a Channing Tatum movie pre-production.
So the Kingsman and the sequels are that ilk of the Avengers. That very proper British secret spy who, you know, fights with one hand while he's drinking champagne with the other kind of thing. And that's where Barbara Shelley actually came from.
Okay.
Originally. But she went on. And then the other one, last one I'll talk about is Roni, who.
Yeah. Now I know him from something. Yeah.
You should. Two important movies, Bridge on the River Kwai.
Okay. Well, I mean, but that's an old school. Yeah. Both those movies are like movies that were out when I was a kid. Like,
yes.
Too young to go see movies, probably.
Yes, but James Donald was a very well known, and he actually got top billing above.
Well, he's very strong in this.
Oh yeah, he's really good in this, and you know, of course, you get to do the sacrifice play at the end. Of course, you're going to be.
He's the guy on the crane.
Yep, he's your crane guy.
Hey, so fire monster, eat me.
He's your childhood memory. So
yeah,
there you
he
go.
Is. He is my total childhood memory. And I guess if we never did really go over any kind of scenes, but if I was going to have to pick one, that would definitely be one.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And like I said, mine would definitely be the when you first see the ship revealed for the full time, when they've washed it down and dug it out. It looks so cool and a cool design. First time you see the quote Martians, the last image with the, you know, or the last fight with the crane and the big ghost bug, and everything else. Mm-hmm. And then I remember the war memories because I remember what they were, even as a kid, I knew what they were trying to do. It just looked so bad.
Oh, you're talking about the cricket battle on Mars.
Yeah. That should be our subtitle for this episode.
Yeah.
Cricket battle on Mars.
It's basically just, they filmed a bunch of crickets puppets, crawling all over each other, and then distorted it and added colors and stuff to make it look like chaos or whatever with insects.
Yeah, and not even real. I mean, they were cricket puppets because they were all much.
Some of them were. They were like shadow puppets in a line.
It was really bad.
I forgot about that.
Really bad. I knew what they were trying to do, but man, they just didn't do it.
You want to talk about some more bad stuff. There's a few bad things that are quite clearly almost television Star Trek. I have Star Trek as a key because a lot of these sets and the things remind me of something you would see on Star Trek, the original show. And one of them is when they're digging skulls and stuff out of the mud. And then all of a sudden, you know, almost instantly, he's got a recreation of one and what it would look like.
Oh, yeah.
I was like, how the hell did you do that so fast?
You know, what? Professor, what do you think they would look like? Well, come step right over here. I've just done a brief.
Here, I have this model I've made.
I have a full-size mock-up I've got.
And it's basically cranium. Like a Neanderthal ape-type man with an extended head because they're Martian hybrids.
Yeah, yeah. And there's other definite 60s production design to it. Like I've got in my notes, this is the brightest church in the world because, when they go to, when they finally catch up with the guy that you had the picture of, the spammer or whatever his name was, he was the guy with the drill who mm-hmm. went crazy. And they finally catch up with him in the abbey with the priest. It is, everything is so hugely television lit. I was like, okay. This is terrible. And then they have the bounce. Other notes I've got. They have the bounciest rocks.
They are. Some of the rocks are clearly foam, and you can see them bounce. Yes,
so
that's
true.
That's a Star Trek thing too, though.
Yep. Yeah. Hampered by special effects because, like, they want to do this whole destruction thing at the end, and they resort to like Jerry Anderson, miniatures. Mm-hmm. For like the buildings collapsing and even the crane, it's a miniature.
Yeah.
And you can tell, but you go with it.
It's still cool. And if you're a kid, you could easily get caught up in it, which is, I guess, why I still remembered that giant monster at the end. I loved the subway set, which was the main set. They used it the most. It looked real. It looked like a real British. I haven't been on a British subway since the 90s, and that was in the 60s, but it still reminded me of the one I was on in the 90s, that station. Yeah,
The tube. The tube set looked, yes. And the only thing I didn't like about it was the thing I have from the very beginning, which is all of the signage in this movie is too much like Batman the series. It's too much in your face sort of thing. Even the signage on like the control panels and everything.
Oh, yeah. Like laboratory. This lever does that. This lever does this. Yeah.
Well, like even when they call in, we're going to call in the military. And then it cuts to these two cars driving in, and each one of them has a huge sign on the hood of the car that says Bomb Squad in great big red letters.
Yeah, you're right.
Not even. It's just terrible. The signage is terrible.
But, well, I thought you were referring to the posters because did you notice that all the posters?
No, they were too. Yep.
But the posters down in the subway were all old Hammer movies, vampire movies and stuff. It was great.
Yes. It was. But really hugely complex, heady thematics through this that they just barely have time to touch on. He just, when he says stuff like gargoyles, horned demons, all of that could be buried in our subconscious, and you're going, yeah. And I remember as a kid going, that's right. Monsters are in our subconscious,
What if we tap into them?
That's why, to me, I could see this being on Shock Theater as a horror movie. Mm-hmm. More so than a science fiction, even though science fiction is the core.
Just wait. It'll be on Shudder next month. I guarantee it. And then we wouldn't have had to buy the DVD.
Then we wouldn't have to buy it. I think that's most of my notes, too. If you want to go to... I don't think there were a lot of awards for this.
I have a little thing on trivia that I don't know if you knew anything about. And I'm assuming it could be tied to the tragedy. But in the late 1990s, it was announced that the director, Alex Proyas, who did The Crow, was going to do a remake of this. But it never materialized. Yeah. And I don't know if it had to do with Brandon Lee's death, because he was one of those. He was an actor that was accidentally killed on the set of that movie, The Crow.
Right.
Or if it just, got lost in development hell. So, I did find that interesting, though, because I like that movie, The Crow. That was a good movie.
This is a movie I think could be modernized and updated, as I don't like reboots or remakes.
Well, the special effects would be better for sure.
Well, I could also see them exploring more of an alien influence. Maybe it's not Martians, but it's an alien influence.
Another planet.
One of my keys is Star Trek because of this whole thing about seeding life throughout the galaxy sort of thing, which was a big Gene Roddenberry concept that he put in several episodes. Some master superior alien race that went around just seeding the cosmos and developing it sort of thing.
Yeah.
So
my biggest key, we mentioned Stephen King as far as that one character being very Stephen King-esque. But Stephen King wrote a terrible, well, it's terrible, but I still remember it fondly, novel in the 80s called The Tommyknockers. And this,
oh God,
it is quite clear that he was like drinking and watching this movie one night really late and went, I'm going to write this, and just wrote this story about a woman that stumbles upon a buried spaceship with.
That is so true.
And there's like,
oh my
God. I don't remember if there's alien corpses, but there's alien ghosts, and these people of this town start becoming possessed by the spirits that were in that alien spaceship. Mm-hmm. So it's not as, like you said, heady or intellectual as much as it is more of a possession type story, just possession of another species.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah.
But it's,
and it was not good.
No, it's not great. They made a version of it in the 90s with Jimmy Smits. It's not great. And anyway, but it's very memorable. And now that I've seen this movie, I'm like, holy shit, he ripped that off. I mean, you can tell he lifted the idea from this big time.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a good one. I hadn't thought of that one. I definitely thought of Star Trek, not only because of the seeding, but also because of I've actually got in my notes Return of the Archons. That whole thing at the end where they're all like in groups and they're using their mental, they're just standing there, but they're using their telekinesis to stone that guy to death. Yeah. I was going, oh my God, that's festival sort of thing in Star Trek.
Yeah. You reminded me of another key that reminds me of, that is a very sci-fi key of a movie that we'll probably cover one day, and that's Village of the Damned. All the little children and their psychic ability, and they would band together, you know.
And Barbara Shelley is in that.
Oh, is she? How funny. Yeah. That's great. Yeah.
Well, I mean, thematically, one of the big ones is Forbidden Planet, because it's monsters from the id, creatures from our id coming alive. Oh,
that's a good one. I didn't even think about that.
He even says, I even took it down because I thought it was a great line of dialogue. A name that's been worn out long before anyone showed up to claim it. And he's referring to the word Martian. Because, are you suggesting these are? And he goes, yes, a name that's been worn out long before anyone showed up to claim it. And I was going, oh, that's a cool line.
Yeah, it is a cool line. You know,
and it kind of, it's the writer's way of saying, yeah, so they're Martians, man, so.
Well, you got to remember a lot, and a lot of this is addressed in the beginning of the movie, is it's 1967. It's just 2 years before we landed on the moon, and they're talking about the space race throughout the beginning of this movie and who's going to get to the moon first and what's next, because they're talking, oh, we'll be colonizing the moon in about 10 years. We'll all be living there.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
I've got 2001. And I don't know if Clark was influenced by this movie or maybe the serial or whatever, but he might have been, because again, things planted by an alien race, which changed our evolution.
Yeah.
And then later on, we end up going, exploring further.
Now, that's a great key. That's a great key. And I seem to remember in the interview with one of there's one guy on there that's an actor and a writer, and I cannot remember his name, but he does the most in-depth talk about this of all the interviews on that DVD. And
talking about Mark Gatiss.
Yes, and it's Mark Gatiss, and he talks about Arthur C. Clarke and whether or not this movie could have potentially influenced him or vice versa. Yeah.
Oh, I'm sure he did. I'm sure it did. I didn't watch that interview, but Mark Gatiss is brilliant. He's responsible for Sherlock. The one that Cumberbatch.
I didn't know who he was. It just said that he was an actor and a writer. And I said, well, let me just look at a little bit of this. And I got that's the one interview that caught my attention more than anybody.
Yep. So. Yeah. Done a lot of BBC stuff. He's a good television movie director, writer, actor. Hmm. I've got The Day the Earth Stood Still in my keys, because, you know, the whole thing about you can't cut through it. It's harder than diamond. We try a blowtorch. That doesn't work. We try everything else. That reminded me of straight out of Day the Earth Stood Still.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, you can't mention the M word from another planet without thinking of War of the Worlds. That's Martian invasion time.
Well, I was going to bring up just, and you had already brought it up earlier, H.G. Wells in general. This whole story reminds me of H.G. Wells.
This, I'm sure H.G. Wells smiled when this was written. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's his kind of storytelling, too. Mm-hmm. I've got Stephen King, like you did, but I also have Clive Barker, because I seem to remember a Clive Barker short story about unearthing something. Of course, that's a lot of Clive Barker's, is unearthing something, but unearthing something that took possession of them. And for some reason, I was just going, this has a lot of Clive Barker vibes to me. If it got a lot more gorier and brutal, it would definitely be Clive Barker.
Well, and I can't remember a possession story, but there is a story called Rawhead Rex where a demon is released from beneath a rock by a farmer.
Yeah.
But it ties more into the stuff you were talking about, the Celtic pagan type stuff, not aliens. Yeah.
Yeah.
But yeah, I could see that.
Yeah, that's why I had
anything that's found buried, basically.
Yeah, it's a key.
Scary things found buried underneath the ground.
Well, and I had altered states because of the genetic memory. You know, because in that he goes by taking the Brujas potion, he goes back and experiences genetic regression.
Mm-hmm.
And this doesn't go that far, but it says that all of those things, racism, cultural hatred, warfare, all of that is coming from this genetic memory we had instilled in us when we were made hybrids by the Martians.
Mm-hmm.
Which is, you know, that's some big
stuff. It's some pretty heavy stuff. I mean, that's maybe one reason why it wasn't as popular over here. I don't know. And why they changed the name. Well, I mean, I guess they changed the name because it was a character we weren't familiar with. 5 million years to
Earth.
Earth, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, either way, and that's the way I originally knew it, because I kept confusing it as a kid when I would see it in the TV guide with 8 million miles to Earth, which was the Ray Harryhausen one where the spaceship crashes and the monster comes out and everything.
And that's called 8 million miles to Earth, because I get it confused with the Raquel Welch one, which is something million years BC.
Yeah. There's 5 million years.
Yeah, it's like back in the 60s, man, all these movies were coming out with millions in the title. And I was like, I can't keep
millions was a lot, unlike trillions now. You know?
Right.
I've got three keys left. So one is organic hulls, because this, it talks about this hull. There's nothing alive in the ship. But the ship itself is alive. The ship itself is an organic composite. So when they give it power, that's what activates it, or reanimates it.
There's movies. You have to have an example. I'm trying to think. I mean, not necessarily the alien movies, but there's some movie out there with organic ships in it.
Well, Farscape, the ship is the entire series. The ship is sentient. The ship is an organic ship.
Okay.
And Babylon 5, the Vorlon ships in Babylon 5 are organic.
Yeah, but this is something I would have seen. I can't remember, but I seem to remember. I mean, the ships in Alien are very organic looking, but they're not organic.
Correct.
I want to say I've seen something that has organic ships in it. I don't know. I can't think of it. Oh, well.
All right. If anybody out there listening or watching thinks of it, let us know.
Yeah. Please do.
And I've got this is kind of a weird key, but the Barbara Shelley in this, who played Barbara, reminds me of the girl from Deadly Mantis. Just the way she's written, the way she's done everything, you know, because she sometimes is right there and has a great idea, and then she's in the background being, I'll serve you coffee, you know, kind of
thing. I know exactly what it is. It's because that you reverse perspective, and she's just a giant woman amongst tiny little corpses of mantises.
Oh yeah, that. Yeah.
I mean, basically, it is the opposite, except until the end when you've got the giant one. Then it is a giant mantis.
Yeah. And then it is her. Yeah.
So there's little bugs and giant bugs, and a woman that runs around looking like someone from Deadly Mantis.
And then, of course, I've got Doctor Who, because this is such a Doctor Who feel to it. And you could have actually, you could make this a Doctor Who episode, just have him come back to right before they discover it. And he fulfills the role of Quatermass.
Well, I was going to say, because more people identify now with Who than they do Quatermass. So it would make more sense if it was a Doctor Who story.
Yeah, much more. Yeah. Much more. But overall, I really liked this movie. It was so neat watching it again. I have not watched this probably in 20 years.
I told you. It's been so long. I had repressed it and didn't remember it. And still don't really remember having seen it before, other than that ending with the guy on the crane fighting the giant monster with the big eyes.
And I thought about, oh, you just made me think of it because you showed that.
Oh, I put Hellfighters as a key because I always associated it with a John Wayne movie about firefighters. It's my key. It's no one else's key. It's my key.
There was a movie that this would make a good double feature with, which was the one where the guys make the spacecraft that can go to the moon. And they end up going there and discovering that there's an ancient civilization that lives underneath it of bugs, crickets, like cricket people.
Is it British?
Yes, it's very British. And it's got that title, like one of those, you know, 10 million miles to Earth or something like that.
Well, Mario Bava's Planet of the Vampires has them going to a planet and there's vampires living under the ground. They come out of this big door. And I love that movie. That's got great costumes. I would put that on here just for the hell of it. Cause you will be amazed at how much Ridley Scott was influenced by that movie with Alien.
Oh, I'm sure.
Yeah.
Okay. The one I'm trying to think of, finally, I looked it up just real quick. It's called First Men in the Moon. And it would make an incredibly good pairing with this movie just because it's more H.G. Wells and it's actually excellent. And we should actually do this movie because I love
this
movie.
Put it on the list. Is it on the list?
And I'm just looking it up and it was written by Nigel Neal.
Oh, well, there you go.
Just, oh my God. You have definitely this. That is the key. You should put it in there because literally the teaser of it, Tim, is it's the first, you know, U.S. landing on the moon, and it's a big deal, and we're landing on the moon, and we step out, and one giant leap, and yada, yada, and we look over, and on top of this rock is a British flag. And they go, what? And they go over to this old, dusty British flag that is planted on the rock, and there's a letter beside it with this guy's name. They look him up. He's like 80 years old. And he went to the moon at the turn of the century.
Oh, it's an H.G. Wells story. He adapted the screenplay.
Yeah. It's really good. It's really good. Anyway, we should add that to our list. You just reminded me of it because the insects in it, the moon, they call them solanites. They look like that little bug behind you that are the Martian survivors.
Okay.
Yep.
Are you talking about the little corpse or are you talking about the giant one?
No, the corpse.
The corpse. Okay, cool. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, those look really good to me. I especially loved the green sludge that came out of one of them. I was really
irked. I'm sure you liked that.
I actually saw somebody talking about it. It may have been one of the special effects interviews where he said that green goo beat The Exorcist hands down or something.
Oh, I'm sure it was like pea soup and something else because it was thick and gross.
It was really nasty looking. And it was it really sucked because it was like they only had so many minutes to like capture these creatures because once they were exposed to air, they started to deteriorate really fast. It was as if that vessel was keeping them intact.
Yeah. And from a screenplay wise, that's where it fell apart for me. I wish they had had, you know, another half hour to explore and like look at the aliens and look at the ship and look at the stuff before we suddenly got into, oh, everybody's going to try to kill each other sort of thing. So
mass hysteria.
Yeah. Dogs and cats living together.
Giant monsters on, you know, knocking down
crickets
cities.
Crickets with cranes.
Oh my God. No. That's kind of a Ghostbusters clue now that you think about it. A key,
actually. Yeah,
because there is all of a sudden a giant monster at the end, just like Ghostbusters. Yeah. Oh my God.
Don't cross the streams. Don't cross the cranes.
Oh.
Yeah.
Who's the key master?
Yeah. but I'm really glad we covered it. I think it was a lot of fun.
Me too. Yeah, I was looking forward to it because I had never seen it. And then when I got a chance to watch the Blu-ray, I was even more thrilled because it's Hammer. I was like, holy shit, it's a Hammer movie. And it's in beautiful color and it's Blu-ray. And I was like, this is awesome. So yeah, I really enjoyed it.
Well done.
Well,
all right.
That brings us to a close to this, our, what episode is this, David?
We're in season.
This is episode 25. We are well into the second half of the season. We'd like to thank you guys for joining us today. If you're listening to us on your podcast platform of choice, or if you're watching us on YouTube, don't forget to scroll down and like us and ring that bell. It's a small gesture on your part and means the world and Mars to us.
And Mars.
And Mars. And if you are hankering for a little bit more of Johnny Has the Keys, you can find us over on Patreon. We have several bonus episodes that are free for public viewing, as well as a couple of subscription shows on The X-Files and the original Star Trek. David, my friend, as always, it has been a pleasure being here with you this week.
You as well.
See you soon.
See you soon.
All righty. Bye.
Thank you so much for listening to Johnny Has the Keys. You can learn more about us at our website, johnnyhasthekeys.com, and our Facebook page. Avoid missing shows by subscribing on iTunes and Google Play, and please, please like, rate, and review us. We're doing this for genre geeks like ourselves, and we can't continue without your support. See you next show, and don't lose your keys.